Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we'll have coverage of the historic Women's March, locally and nationally. Then hear about new lead testing of water in public schools. Hear about storm damage across our region and how you can report damage that could help get federal or state disaster declarations for San Diego County. Now, you may be surprised to learn that as of last week, some local reservoirs in East County are still very low. On our consumer report, we'll have news about a cat food recall, and if you buy milk, you may be eligible for some money back. Learn about a major insurer that's refusing an order to refund money to ratepayers. In East County news, hear about a sheriff's coffee with the community in Lemon Grove and a council vacancy in Santee. Then on our Capitol report, learn about Donald Trump's nominee for the Environmental Protection Agency and why environmentalists are concerned. Plus, hear why one Trump appointee has already bowed out. On Green Scene, learn about Trump's pick to head up the Department of the Interior and why nurses are getting active on climate change. If you love wine and need work, listen up to learn about a new viticulture apprenticeship program locally. Plus, hear why farmers are asking supervisors for the freedom to grow cannabis in our backcountry. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news, including the latest in Trump's war on the media, problems faced by LGBT students, and tornadoes ravaging parts of the U.S. We'll have some storm safety tips for you and information on where to find sandbags if your property is getting saturated. Plus, hear which major public official has announced she won't be seeking re-election. We'll have all those stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery from the East County Magazine show on KNSJ with a report on the Women's March in San Diego on Saturday. The march drew an estimated 2.9 million people worldwide, including some 40,000 marchers in downtown San Diego and another 10,000 in North County. It's now being recognized as the largest protest ever in U.S. history. CNN called it a remarkable protest against Donald Trump on his first full day as president. Trump denounced media reports that the Women's March drew 2 to 3 times more people than his inauguration the day before. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined in the march. Hillary Clinton sent a tweet in support, stating, "Thanks for standing, speaking, and marching for our values." At the Spring Street trolley station in La Mesa, hundreds of East County residents converged to join the protest. Women and men, young and old, straight and gay, white, black, Asian, and Latino, and all shared one common goal, forging a resistance coalition opposed to the policies of President Donald Trump that are poised to weaken rights and freedoms for women, minorities, and many other Americans. Many of the activists marching were young women, following in the footsteps of their mothers, grandmothers, and great-grandmothers who have marched for women's rights in the past. For others, this was a first foray into activism. A large number of the marchers wore pink knitted caps with pussycat ears, symbolic reminders of Trump's crude boast caught on tape about grabbing women against their will. Trolleys filled up, and MTS added extra trolley cars. But the marchers kept coming. They lined both sides of the station platform, carrying signs and in some cases toting babies on their backs. Downtown, they marched from the Civic Center Plaza, down the Embarcadero to the County Administration Center, in a procession that stretched for over a mile. Speakers shared their own reasons for why they marched. And now we're going to play an excerpt of several minutes from that rally at the San Diego Women's March.
Good morning, San Diego! How are you? You are the beautiful faces of America, and I am proud to be here with you today. I join members of the State Assembly and the Senate and lots of local elected officials here today. I march for dreamers. I march for immigrants. I march for women. I march
continue the important work of equity, diversity, and inclusion. For 25 years, San Diego State has developed Chicana activists at San Diego State, Alliance International University of San Diego. Achistas, I ask you today to recommit yourself for social justice. We cannot have someone decide what to do with our bodies, with our children, and our families. And as an educator, I take pride in providing access to all students to an equitable education to level the playing ground. It is our responsibility to fight for our children. And I cannot say that we have a responsibility today for every children in our community. But I also want to say that everyone has a responsibility. So I want to give a shout out to Samuel Mana, who are over here, and they are supporting our hermanitas, helping our girls succeed, helping them understand that the career path is the way to come and serve our communities. To our LGBT community, brothers and sisters, you're not alone. The fight's gonna be harder. We are here with you, we'll march with you, next to you, with you. Our struggles even become harder. For our children, for our future, I march today.
Tomorrow, but in the future, with these janitors who are our security people along this route, with people who demand education for all of our children, not just some of them, with our LGBT family members and friends, with our Muslim neighbors, relatives, leaders, we are marching today saying we are going to be marching tomorrow. Let us put our hands up for tomorrow. Woo! Good morning, San Diego! My name is Joelle Fields, and I am a proud Filipina American. I march for my parents who are immigrants from the Philippines, like many immigrants that seek the American dream. I march for my four young children, Jonathan, Darius, Javon, and Camry. I march for Jonathan and his growing family that they may be able to afford their own home one day. I march for my son, Darius, and his wife, Tiffany, who serve in the U.S. military, like so many of our sons and daughters. I march for my son, Javon, and my daughter, Camry, who are full-time college students so that they can get an affordable, livable wage. I march for Southeast San Diego so that we have quality schools, so that African Americans, Latinos, Filipinos, Southeast Asians, all people have a quality school so that they can be competitive in an international world. I march for all San Diegans because we are told to move on. We are told that we need to do all that we can do and do what is best for our country. But to move on would be to accept, normalize, and legitimize the hate, fear, intimidation, racism, and fascism Donald Trump advocates. This is not who we are. This is not what America is. To do what is best for the country leaves us with only one option. That is to deny, defy, and denounce the tyranny of Donald Trump as President of the United States. Now is the time to rise up, to organize. Now is the time to oppose, to protest, to fight back and resist, and never, never give up, because we can.
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report. California's State Water Resources Control Board wants to help schools get the lead out. To help protect students' health, the State Board this week announced it will give a free lead testing kit to any K-12 school that asks for one. All community water systems or districts will be required to test schools' drinking water on request. The actions were prompted by national news stories on lead pollution in water, notably in Flint, Michigan. Governor Jerry Brown ordered that schools be included in water tests for lead. California has about 9,000 K-12 schools served by over 3,000 community water systems. Our state has newer infrastructure and less corrosive water than other parts of the U.S., so high lead levels in drinking water are uncommon. But while water districts in California do test drinking water for lead, the toxic heavy metal could still get into clean water at a school if there were corroded pipes or old fixtures at the campus. Darren Paul Hemmes, Deputy Director of the State Water Board's Division on Drinking Water, says the extra testing will help ensure we are continuing to protect our most vulnerable populations. Under the new requirement, testing is voluntary for schools, but if the schools make a written request, the community water systems must collect the samples within 3 months and report the results back to the school within 2 business days. Sampling locations can include drinking fountains, cafeteria and food preparation areas, and reusable water bottle filling stations. The program ends November 1, 2019. The community water systems are responsible for the costs associated with collecting drinking water samples, analyzing them, and reporting results through this new program. However, the State Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance will have some funding available to help if lead is found in a school's water, particularly in disadvantaged communities. Under the federal lead and copper rule, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency already requires public water systems to test for lead at customers' taps, targeting the highest-risk homes based on the age of their plumbing. California's compliance rate with the lead and copper rule is among the highest in the country, but the rule does not require testing for schools and businesses. The board's new requirement ensures schools that want lead testing can receive it for free. Existing federal and state programs provide guidance to help schools determine if a lead problem exists and how to remedy the contamination. Protecting children from lead exposure is important for their development and lifelong good health. Lead exposure can affect nearly every system in the body. Even low levels of lead in blood have been shown to affect children's learning abilities, IQ, ability to pay attention, and academic achievement. The effects of lead exposure are permanent and can't be corrected, so it's important to prevent lead exposure.
Storms have wreaked havoc across San Diego County for the past 5 days, causing flooding, power outages, toppled trees, and damage to roadways, homes, and businesses. The County of San Diego is asking all property owners to report damage, which could help get federal or state disaster declarations and funds to help those who suffered losses. If you had damage, you can fill out a form at sdcountyrecovery.com. The storm sent a 45-foot tree crashing down onto an apartment building in National City, and another onto the roof of the VHS building in Alpine. It turned University Avenue in La Mesa into a stream and led to swift water team rescues in the Rolando area and Mira Mesa. The San Diego River flooded, causing closure of many roads in Mission Valley. A boulder blocked a roadway in Poway, and a sinkhole opened up in Oceanside. In City Heights, residents at one apartment complex found their units completely underwater after a storm drain backed up, while in Ocean Beach, a high wave swept 2 people on shore into the sea, killing one of them. The storm dumped over 6 inches of water in many San Diego County communities, as well as over 1 foot of snow on Mount Laguna, bringing snow levels down to about 3,500 feet. More rain is expected tonight and through Tuesday. Please stay safe and stay tuned to weather reports as the wet weather continues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Even after heavy rainfalls doused our region, 3 East County reservoirs remain at very low levels. As of January 9th, the most recent records available, Lake Morena is at just 2.1% of capacity, Barrett Lake is at 5.5%, and Sutherland 7.3% of capacity, according to the city of San Diego, which owns the reservoirs. These are the only local reservoirs not connected to the state water project system of canals and aqueducts, so they are solely dependent on rainfall, which has not been enough to replenish large quantities of water pumped out by the city of San Diego to meet its thirst for water. Lake Moreno's level is far below the level at which the city of San Diego promised to cease its drawdown. But even after the city stopped pumping back in February 2014, the water level continued to fall due to evaporation. The lake has risen about a foot in the past couple of months from rainfall, according to county staff, but has not had enough rain for Cottonwood Creek, the main stream that feeds the lake, to flow into Lake Moreno. Residents have long voiced anger and frustration over negative impacts on wildlife, scenery, the tourism economy of the lakefront community, property values, as well as the quality and availability of well water at nearby properties. Homes and cabins that once overlooked a verdant lake now have vistas of a dry lake bed or brackish puddles. Meanwhile, neighbors of these lakes have had their water rates continue to rise. Barrett Lake in Dilsura was once a fisherman's paradise. Lake Sutherland in Ramona is also a shadow of its former presence. Repairs and upgrades to the dam at Lake Morena are expected to be made starting in 2018, with completion slated for 2020. One reason why the city lowered the water level so far. After that, the lake will still be dependent on natural rainfall to fill it. And even then, the city could decide to take more water, a staffer at Supervisor Diane Jacobs' office told East County Magazine. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a consumer report for East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio. If you bought milk or other dairy products such as yogurt, half and half, or cream anytime since 2003, you may be eligible for a refund through a class action suit that alleges price fixing by the dairy industry. Claims must be submitted by January 31st. The suit applies to consumers in 15 states, including California, who bought milk from a grocery store or other retailer. The National Milk Producers Federation and others in the dairy products industry denied guilt, but have agreed to settle the case for $52 million. To be eligible for a share of the settlement, you must have purchased milk products for consumption, not for resale. No proof of purchase is required. The amount you could receive will be based on the number of products claimed, as well as the number of valid claims submitted. For more information, you can call 877-417-4561, send an email to info@boughtmilk.com, or visit classactionrebates.com/settlements/fresh-milk.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is John Fistier with an important warning for cat owners. A cat food recall has been expanded to include certain lots of Nine Lives, Special Kitty, and Everpet brands made by J.M. Smucker due to possible low levels of thiamin, vitamin B1, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced. Cats fed low in thiamin for several weeks may be at risk for developing a thiamin deficiency, and thiamin is essential for cats. Symptoms of deficiency displayed by an affected cat can be gastrointestinal or neurological. Early signs of thiamin deficiency may include decreased appetite, salivation, vomiting, and weight loss. In advanced cases, neurological signs can develop, which include the neck bending forwards, wobbly walking, circling, falling, and seizures. While no illnesses have been reported, if your cat has any of these symptoms, you should contact your veterinarian immediately, since thiamin deficiency is usually reversible if treated promptly. The recalled products were distributed to retailers between December 20th and January 3rd. For more information on this and previous pet food recalls, you can visit fda.gov and type pet food recall into the search bar.
The California Department of Insurance has issued a notice of non-compliance charging State Farm General Insurance Company with refusing to reduce policyholders' rates as mandated by Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones's order. Commissioner Jones's order, issued in November, directed State Farm to reduce homeowners' and renters' rates by 7% overall, accounting to approximately $84 million in savings to consumers over the next year, and issue refunds totaling more than $110 million to State Farm policyholders. State Farm filed multiple requests to stay this order, but on December 16th, the San Diego Superior Court denied State Farm's request, finding that delaying these rate reductions would be against the public interest. This decision means State Farm must decrease its rates pursuant to Commissioner's orders, effective last December 8th. But State Farm continues to deny the court and the Commissioner's orders. The company told the staff at the State Insurance Department that it won't implement the rate reduction order until February 13th because State Farm claims an additional 50 days is required to issue renewal notices. The insurance commissioner estimates that over 4,000 ratepayers could be affected by the company failing to implement rate reductions from December 8th to February 17th. Commissioner Jones says, "I expect every insurance company to comply with my rate orders. The orders I issue under Proposition 103 ensure that Californians do not pay excessive rates. It is unclear what penalties the insurance commissioner or a court may levy on State Farm for ignoring orders to put money back into its customers' pockets." Jones ordered the rate reduction after considering voluminous evidence that actuarial analysis that were presented during a lengthy public hearing process, which revealed State Farm's rates were excessive and unjustified. State Farm originally requested a rate increase of 6.9%. Based on the evidence presented during a public hearing, however, Commissioner Jones determined that the rates State Farm is currently charging are excessive. He ordered State Farm to reduce its homeowners' insurance rates by an average of over 5%, condominium insurance rates by nearly 14%, and renters' insurance rates by an average of over 20%, for a weighted average of 7% reduction overall. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
The Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substation invites you to a coffee with the community on Wednesday, January 25th from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. at the Lemon Grove Community Center. The Sheriff's Department says community outreach is a top priority and members of the community should feel comfortable bringing problems related to safety and security to their staff. The event gives the public a chance to chat with the station's command staff, deputies, crime prevention specialists, and senior volunteers in a casual setting to exchange ideas or concerns. And you can also enjoy coffee and cookies. You're encouraged to come out and make a positive difference in your community. For more information, Lemon Grove residents can contact Crime Prevention Specialist Jim Wiebolt at 619-337-2039 or visit sdsheriff.net.
This is Jonathan Getz with a report from Santee. Santee's City Council is looking for a new member to fill the vacancy left by former Councilman John Minto, who was elected to serve as mayor. There are 2 years remaining in his term. At the council's January 11th meeting, the four members decided to appoint Minto's successor rather than hold a special election, which was deemed too costly. But that decision didn't come easily. At first, two motions were made to fill the vacancy outright by appointing specific individuals, but both motions deadlocked in tie votes 2-2. Two members wanted to appoint former Assemblyman Brian Jones, while two others wanted to appoint Dustin Trotter, who finished second in the council election won by Stephen Houlihan. At the meeting, five people said they are interested in taking the job. In addition to Trotter and Jones, others are Don Gibbs, a local business owner, Van Collingsworth, the president of an environmental nonprofit, and Arnold Winston, a retired banker. Ultimately, council approved accepting applications from all interested candidates. That motion passed 3-1 with Councilman Rob McNellis opposed. Applications are available on the City of Santee website and City Hall. The deadline to apply is January 23rd. Applicants must be registered voters and residents in Santee. Applicants will be interviewed in a public meeting Wednesday, January 25th.
This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Capital Report. After multiple revelations of plagiarism, Monica Crowley has announced that she is stepping down from her appointment by Donald Trump to serve as Director of Communication at the National Security Council. An investigation by CNN's K-File found over 50 instances of plagiarism in Crowley's book, What the Bleep Just Happened, prompting publisher HarperCollins to pull the book off store sales, pending updates with attribution to sources. CNN also discovered that Crowley's dissertation at Columbia University over 16 years ago included thousands of words plagiarized from other sources. Her columns for The Washington Times and a piece in The Wall Street Journal have also been exposed as having sections that appeared to have been copied from other sources without credits. Crowley is a prominent conservative author and commentator formerly with Fox News. Crowley issued a statement Monday indicating she will remain in New York to pursue other opportunities and will not be taking a position in the incoming administration, though she added that she will continue to enthusiastically support Trump and his agenda.
Donald Trump's pick to run the EPA, Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, faces strong opposition by environmental and progressive groups, including the League of Conservation Voters. That group's Vice President, Tiernan Sittenfeld, says the person who runs the EPA has a big impact on California policies and politics. Sittenfeld notes that Pruitt has already made headlines for suing the EPA multiple times and has been accused of accepting money from energy companies in his role as a state attorney general.
It is hard to imagine that Donald Trump could have nominated a worse person to be the administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. The mission is to protect human health and the environment, our air, our water, and our land. Everything about him, his beliefs, his record, his actions, is completely antithetical to the vitally important mission of the EPA.
Facing questions on his position on climate change during yesterday's confirmation hearing, Pruitt acknowledged that the climate is changing, but said what to do about it is up for debate. Sittenfeld says California has been a national leader on conservation and energy efficiency issues, but it could be in constant conflict with Pruitt as head of the EPA.
This is literally someone who we have seen not just sue the EPA, seemingly in conjunction with particular companies, whether it's ExxonMobil or Devon Energy or Murray Energy. He's also sued the EPA over preventing wildlife from being added to the endangered species list.
Oklahoma has made news in recent years with its unprecedented number of man-made earthquakes, caused in many cases by the oil drilling method known as fracking. Pruitt's critics say he could have been a leader on protecting residents by addressing this problem. For Public News Service, I'm Logan Pollard.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report. Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Interior Department voiced strong support for protecting public lands in his confirmation hearing before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. The nominee, Representative Ryan Zinke from Montana, testified, "Let me be clear about this. I'm absolutely against the transfer or sale of public lands." That puts him at odds with the leadership of the Republican Party. If confirmed, Zinke would be in charge of managing hundreds of millions of acres that belong to all Americans as national parks, Bureau of Land Management lands, national forests and wildlife refuges, as well as conserving western water resources. Zinke also took a stand that's polar opposite of Trump's climate change denial. Asked about climate change, Zinke told committee members, "I don't believe it's a hoax." The Montana Republican cited shrinking glaciers in his own home state's Glacier National Park as evidence. He added that man is an influence on climate change and that the debate should focus on what we can do about it. His most important priority, however, will be to restore trust between the Interior Department and the states and Native American tribes that it serves, said Zinke. He is a self-described fan of Theodore Roosevelt, founder of the National Forest and National Park Systems. Trump has said his administration would honor the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt. During his presidency, Roosevelt cemented his legacy as a conservation hero by establishing 150 national parks, as well as 51 federal bird reserves, 4 national game preserves, 5 national parks, and 18 national monuments on over 230 million acres of public land set aside. Sinke says he favors the National Forest's multiple-use model that allows uses such as grazing, timber mining, wind, solar, and other energy uses, as well as hunting, fishing, camping, hiking, and other recreational pursuits. Chris Wood, president and CEO of Trout Unlimited, a fisheries conservation group, said the hearing sheds light on the Trump administration priorities. Wood states, "Most important for sportsmen and women is that the Secretary of Interior champion clean water, healthy habitat, and keeping public lands in public hands." Zinke feels so strongly about not selling or giving away public lands that he actually resigned as a delegate to the Republican National Convention last summer because of the party's position in favor of land transfers to state or private groups. However, Zinke drew fire for his vote earlier this month in favor of a measure from House Republicans that would allow federal land transfers to be considered cost-free and budget-neutral, which makes it easier for things like drilling and development to occur on public lands, or transfer them to state ownership, which could put some at risk of being sold off to private owners. Zinke later said he would have voted against that provision if it had been a standalone bill. But Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruhn voiced concern over what he calls a big gap between Zinke's words and actions on public land transfers into private hands. During the confirmation hearing, Zinke voiced support for using scientifically based management, as well as safeguards such as the National Environmental Policy Act to protect clean air and water. But he also said he backs mining of coal and oil on some public lands. Cuts to the Interior Department budget by the Republican Congress in recent years has created a $12 billion backlog of maintenance and repair in our national parks and other public lands. Zinke has proposed tackling that backlog by making deferred maintenance and repairs part of Trump's infrastructure improvement plan. He says allowing public lands to fall into disrepair has eroded the public trust, giving rise to calls for transferring public land into private hands. Now, a lot is at stake. In the West, the federal government controls nearly one-third of all lands. Zinke has indicated he believes states should have a voice on monument designations, raising questions over whether President Obama's designation of several new national monuments will survive efforts by Congress to undo those late-term actions. Wood sees promise in Zinke if confirmed. While challenges facing public lands today have changed from Roosevelt's era, the need to protect and restore fish and wildlife habitat remains, says Woods. He concludes, "America's public lands need to be managed in ways that ensure we pass them along to the next generation healthier, more productive, and more diverse than they are today."
You might not think of nurses as being mindful of the effects of climate change, but it turns out they see its impact every day as a result of the illnesses connected to our changing environment. Katie Hoffling is director of the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments and co-author of a report out this month looking at climate change. She says global warming is visible every day in increased cases of childhood asthma, Lyme disease, and even unhealthy pregnancies. In addition, California's food supply and agricultural communities are impacted by it.
In drought conditions or during heat waves, the plants aren't able to pull up as much nutrients as during a normal crop season. And so one of the concerns that we have is over time, especially with grains, that they may not have the nutritional value that they do now.
Advocates worry the new administration will be less open to seeing connections between climate change and man-made activities. NASA and NOAA have found that 2016 was, in fact, the hottest year on record. Huffling is also worried about how tribal communities may be impacted in the Southwest.
In the Southwest, tribal communities are one of the communities that will be most significantly impacted. And so as nurses, we want to be able to support those communities so that they're not feeling such significant impacts.
The report came out of a summit held late last year by the Obama administration titled 2016 White House Summit on Climate Change, Health and Nursing. For Public News Service, I'm Logan Pollard.
Welcome to Vines and Wines on the East County Magazine Show, bringing you news to savor about our region's fast-growing winemaking industry.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Vines and Wines. Cuyamaca College has secured a state grant of nearly $260,000 to bolster its new viticulture apprenticeship program and cover the cost of planting a 2-acre vineyard at the Water Conservation Garden on the college's campus in Rancho San Diego. The Viticulture Apprenticeship Program, the only one of its kind in Southern California when it launched last fall, aims to address a shortage of qualified workers knowledgeable in vine and pest diseases, irrigation practices, and harvest operations that are critical in the growing viticulture industry. Last fall, funds to support the program were lacking, and only 3 people signed up. The grant from the California Community College's Chancellor's Office will help grow the program and cover operating costs. Graduates of the Viticulture Technician Apprentice Program will leave Cuyamaca College understanding the basic principles of soil science, soil fertility, and irrigation construction, in addition to having the skills needed to plant and maintain vineyards, cultivate and harvest wine grapes, process the product through the bottling process, handle retail operations, and support customer service. Besides taking 14.5 units of courses in the Ornamental Horticulture Department, students also are required to complete 3,000 hours as a paid apprentice. Cuyamaca College President Juliana Barnes predicts, "Our program will play a key leadership role in the region in training future professionals to take on needed roles in the wine industry." San Diego County's wine grape crop has risen in value from $378,000 to $6.5 million in a decade. The San Diego County Farm Bureau reports, "Our county now has more than 100 wineries, according to Supervisor Diane Jacob. Statewide, California's wine industry employs more than 41,000 people, not counting seasonal and temporary employees. California, the 4th largest wine producer in the world, crafts 85% of the wine consumed in the United States. Applicants to the program, which falls under Cuyamaca College's Career and Technical Education Division, must be at least 21 years old. If you are interested in applying for the new program, you can contact Donald Schultz in the Ornamental Horticulture Department at Cuyamaca College by calling 619-660-4023. That number again is 619-660-4023.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Californians legalized the sale of recreational marijuana with Proposition 64 in November, but farmers can't grow cannabis commercially unless they receive a permit from their city or county. So on January 25th, the Southern California Responsible Growers Council will ask San Diego supervisors to allow farmers freedom to grow marijuana and hemp for sale to dispensaries, but not the public, Channel 6 reports. But so far, supervisors who have staunchly opposed even cultivation for hemp growing in our rural regions have shown no indication that they will support easing the restrictions. Anthony Wagner and Micah Anderson with the Southern California Responsible Growers Council wrote an editorial published in the San Diego Union-Tribune which states, "Our goals are to protect small farms, reducing black market activity, and ending trespass grows on public lands." San Diego currently has more small farms of 10 acres or less than any other county in America, according to the County Farm Bureau. But Supervisor Diane Jacob, who represents East County, told Channel 6, "While the county is taking a hard look at its medical marijuana ordinance, the commercial cultivation of marijuana remains prohibited in our unincorporated area, and there are currently no plans to reconsider it." The stakes are high, no pun intended. California could collect up to $1 billion in taxes and licensing revenues from cannabis sales, New Frontier, a cannabis research firm, estimates. But California's new law requires that local jurisdictions that ban cannabis cultivation will get a much smaller share of fees collected by the state, and they'll receive zero local tax revenues. Opinions in rural East County are mixed on whether cannabis cultivation locally should be legalized or not. One rural planning group member told us privately that she might rather see Star Ranch, a 2,000-acre property up for sale in Campo, used for pot growing rather than developed for housing that could negatively impact rural character and overburden services in schools and communities. A reader on the Ranter's Roost discussion forum online agreed, writing, Growing cannabis is a good alternative to homes like wine vineyards. It should be regarded as a better alternative to some dangerous medications and certainly better than tobacco and alcohol. But others strongly oppose legal pot growing. Another Ranter's Roost member posted anonymously, "Wow, solar farms, wind turbine fields as far as the eye can see, the Sunrise Power Link, a proposed voltage power regulating substation, and now contemplating marijuana and or hemp farms? I wonder what next they will try to force upon the backcountry. An Alpine can't even get a high school." George Barnett, who serves on the Alpine Community Planning Group, says he views this as a rational land use issue, aside from the property rights at stake. He notes that property owners across the backcountry have put farm and ranch lands up for sale due to the many challenges of farming that typically require, in his words, a heck of a lot of work by essentially unpaid family members, property tax subsidies such as the Williamson Act, and lots of water. Decades of trying has resulted in zero opportunities for farmers and ranchers to develop their lands, too, he says. Cash-poor farmers or their children may be eager to get into the cannabis cultivation or sell out to pot growers as a result. Barnett sees water as the key stumbling block for commercial pot cultivation in San Diego's backcountry. Marijuana growing typically requires hefty water needs. Barnett says his research indicates it takes a gallon a day per plant to yield each pound of harvestable pot, with a mature plant needing up to 10 gallons a day. And that's an expectation he sees as unrealistic in a region with a semi-desert climate and strict water limits supplied by the County Water Authority, particularly during drought situations. One possible solution to this problem could be hydroponics, which can cut water consumption up to 90%, according to Cirna, a company specializing in supplying indoor cultivators. On the other hand, not allowing any legal cultivation hasn't meant that no pot is grown here. Barnett observes, just about anywhere in the backcountry where there's a trickle of water, you might find a hidden sunlit hillside potted with pot plants watered by drip lines supplied by pumped water from little hand-dug dams that are often on someone else's land, and that means using someone else's water, too. Water theft by illegal pot growers and massive grows in national forests have long plagued officials. But opponents of legal marijuana growing have voiced concerns over crime and access by children, though the law limits possession and use to adults. One tipster told us that a grower of medical pot near the border had solicited local teens to work in the fields, creating a culture of drug use acceptability. Now, currently, the local medical marijuana dispensaries, some legal, some not, rely largely on cannabis imported from Northern California. Selling recreational marijuana through dispensaries won't be legal statewide until 2018, but even then, cities and counties can opt to just ban dispensary sales as well as growing, much to the frustration of people seeking legal access to weed. The new California law does allow individual households to grow up to 6 marijuana plants, though some areas have limited even that. El Cajon, for instance, recently limited growing to indoors only. But not everyone wants to grow their own marijuana, roll their own joint, and smoke it. Nor does that meet the needs of medical marijuana patients who may want other forms of cannabis, such as liquid drops dispensed under the tongue, edible forms such as cookies, creams, or ointments for pain relief, such as for arthritis patients. Advocates of hemp argue that although it's related to marijuana, hemp can be grown without the active ingredient that causes people to get high. Hemp oil has some medical applications, such as in oils and creams. Hemp fiber is prized for its durability in products ranging from blue jeans to rope. Selling such hemp products is legal in the U.S., but the retailers and manufacturers must import hemp raw materials from growers in other countries. Legalizing growth of hemp and or cannabis would create a boom in American jobs, advocates argue. But even in California counties and cities that opt to make growing cannabis or hemp legal, along with dispensaries, jumping into these businesses or using marijuana products is still not risk-free. Growing hemp and cannabis, whether medical or recreational, remains illegal under federal law. While the Obama administration took a largely states' rights approach by not enforcing laws against minor use and possession of marijuana or sale through dispensaries in states that have legalized it, it's unknown what Donald Trump's administration will do. His attorney general nominee has been a vocal opponent of marijuana legalization and could crack down on cannabis. Meanwhile, supervisors will weigh in on January 25th, considering whether weed could become the next cash crop in San Diego County. If they vote no, it may not mean the concept goes up in smoke forever, however. The current crop of supervisors includes four who will be termed out in 2018 and 2020, leaving the door open for pro-cannabis candidates in future elections.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, January 23rd, 2017. I'm Mary Sherman. Stories we're zeroing in on today include alternative facts in President Trump's war with the press, LGBT students still facing hostility at school, and deadly tornadoes sweep through the Southeast. At the top of the list, the news media world found itself in a state of shock Sunday, a day after President Donald Trump declared himself in a running war with the media, and the president's press secretary, Sean Spicer, used his first appearance on the White House podium to accuse members of the press of deliberately false reporting about the inauguration. Spicer said the event drew a record number of spectators, despite photos disproving the claim. Then on Sunday, Trump counselor Kellyanne Conway defended Spicer in a TV interview by saying he had merely presented alternative facts about the inauguration, a statement that sparked outrage on social media. After a post-inauguration weekend capped by women's marches and protests around the globe, it remains to be seen if all this energy will translate into political capital or political theater. Chicago, Illinois' march was one of the largest, so big that the group didn't march to Federal Plaza downtown as planned due to safety concerns. Organizer Ann Scholhammer says she and her colleagues had to make a decision when Chicago police told them there were about 250,000 people at Grant Park.
They just said, look at what you guys did. I mean, they were so overjoyed themselves, and they said, what do you want to do? And I went back to my co-chairs, and we were just like, we broke Chicago, I think.
So what's next? Logan Pollard has more from California.
The women's marches cast a wide net in terms of social justice causes, with participants citing real concerns about losing workers' rights and reproductive rights, religious freedoms, and environmental protections. Amina Maxey was among them. To keep the momentum, Maxey says the focus now is on providing positive alternatives.
Not only are we against these things, but we also are really for solutions that we can demonstrate and that we stand united in.
Speakers at many of the events urged people to channel their energy and beliefs into working to improve their own communities, including running for office.
Counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, said Sunday Trump will not be releasing his tax returns, arguing the returns are irrelevant. During his campaign, Trump repeatedly cited an ongoing IRS audit in refusing to do so, but said he would eventually release them when the audit was completed. WikiLeaks on Sunday responded by inviting its followers to leak Trump's tax returns to them so they can submit them. Previewing the new administration's first full week, White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus said President Trump has no immediate plans to use his executive powers to undo the Obama administration's orders that protect some young illegal immigrants known as Dreamers. Priebus also said Trump could, as early as this week, sign executive orders related to trade, national security, and other aspects of U.S. immigration policy. Meanwhile, churches across the country continue to pledge their support for immigrants who may face deportation under the Trump administration.
Pastor Grant Stevenson says churches have been signing on since the November election as sanctuaries for those seeking refuge in case of the mass deportations promised by Donald Trump during his presidential campaign. Stevenson is part of Isaiah Minnesota, a faith-based coalition forming a network to offer refuge. He calls it encouraging that so many have agreed to help.
When congregations are stepping up to say, we're going to offer sanctuary, they don't know if that's for a week or a month or a year, because we don't actually know exactly what will be coming from the administration.
Trump said during the election he'd deport all immigrants here illegally once elected, but he has since scaled back on that a little, saying the first focus would be on people who have criminal convictions. I'm Veronica Carter reporting.
School is getting better, slowly, for the nation's lesbian, gay, transgender, and questioning students. We get this story from Eric Gladys.
Schools that take steps to reduce bullying and provide other supports for their LGBTQ students are seeing better education outcomes, but the nation's middle and high schools can still be described as hostile environments, according to a new Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network survey. David Danishevsky with the network says even homophobic comments can have profound effects.
When students are experiencing these hostile environments, they're actually missing school more often. They tend to have lower GPAs, they report lower self-esteem, higher rates of depression, and they don't really have a strong sense of school belonging.
The survey found 85% of LGBTQ students were harassed verbally, nearly two-thirds experienced discrimination, and more than 1 in 10 was physically assaulted. Schools with comprehensive anti-bullying policies and sanctioned gay-straight alliances saw lower levels of victimization, and more schools than ever reported classes teaching positive representations of LGBT topics.
Over a dozen people were killed in a string of tornadoes and severe storms that swept through the southeast over the weekend. Throughout Sunday, the National Weather Service warned residents across North Florida and a large portion of Georgia to prepare for a significant tornado outbreak. Even as far north as Atlanta, several metro counties were under tornado watches. January tornado outbreaks are rare but not unprecedented, particularly in the South. Data from the Storm Prediction Center shows that over the past 10 years, the nation has seen an average 38 tornadoes in January. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener-supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
More needed rain is forecast for our region, but some storms may cause serious and dangerous problems. This is Gene Carpenter with some tips to prepare for storms and weather them safely. Always keep a battery-powered radio in your home so that you can tune to radio stations if you lose electricity. Check or change the batteries frequently. Keep a flashlight in an easily accessible spot on every floor of your home. Check the batteries monthly and replace them as needed. As a safety precaution before leaving the house on vacation, unplug all electrical appliances except for those lights connected to automatic timers. Secure, remove outdoor patio furniture and yard accessories to keep them from blowing off in a violent wind. Don't go out unless you have to. However, if flooding threatens, seek high ground and follow the instructions of your local firefighters and law enforcement. Never drive across a flooded roadway, since even a small amount of swiftly moving water can sweep a vehicle into the stream. Keep an eye on large trees, even healthy ones, that could damage your house if felled in a storm. Cut them back if necessary. Lightning can travel 10 miles or more, so when the thunder roars, stay indoors. Lightning can travel through metal pipes, phone, and electrical lines, so it's wise to stay off the phone and computer during a thunderstorm and avoid running water. Turn off and unplug major appliances such as computers or TVs if not grounded to avoid risk of a power surge from lightning or after a power outage, which could damage your equipment. Don't forget the car. Have your brakes, tires, and windshield wipers checked by your mechanic. Drive slower in the rain and give plenty of distance between your vehicle and the one in front of you. Now you can regard gathering clouds with a little less trepidation and stay safe.
This is Jonathan Goetz with the public service announcement from the County of San Diego. The heaviest rains of the winter, and maybe the heaviest in several years, is bringing flash flooding and erosion problems. So the County Department of Public Works, along with CAL FIRE and the County Fire Authority, wants you to know that it's expanded its list of places where residents in unincorporated areas can get free sand and or bags to help protect their properties. The expanded list includes 15 fire stations and other spots where residents can get free sand and bags. All you have to do is bring a shovel to fill them. And another 29 stations giving out free bags. Because different locations are offering sand and bags, just bags, or are asking people to bring shovels to put sand into bags themselves, people should call ahead to check. Proper use of sandbags can help direct waters away from homes and properties. People who have slopes on their land can use mulch or terrace their slopes and plant ground covers and shrubs to keep them from eroding. For more information about how to be prepared for flooding and to get a list of locations in your area offering sand and or bags, go to the County Office of Emergency Services at readysandiego.org/flooding.
Bonnie DeManis has served as San Diego's district attorney for the past 14 years, but this week she announced that she will not seek re-election in 2018. Diagnosed with breast cancer last year, DeManis underwent surgery and radiation and is now cancer-free. But after much soul-searching, consulting with family and colleagues, she told the San Diego Union-Tribune, "I have other things to do. I've been in public service now for 42 years, and you know, I just thought the timing was right." DeManis, 65, added that she has not decided whether to step down before her term ends, in which case supervisors would appoint an interim replacement. Voters would choose a new DA in the 2018 election. DeManis has previously said she would support Summer Stefan, a chief deputy for the post. Stefan has headed up divisions handling sex crimes and human trafficking, but has not said whether she will seek the county's top law enforcement job. As DA, Damanis put emphasis on cracking down on elder abuse, human trafficking, and cyber crimes, also helping released offenders to get job training and life skills to succeed in life and avoid committing new offenses. She handled high-profile cases, notably obtaining a plea bargain from the murderer of abducted teenagers Chelsea King and Amber Dubois. The killer agreed to lead investigators to where he had buried Amber's body in order to avoid the death penalty. Dumanis has prosecuted public officials, including members of the Sweetwater Union School Board, on corruption charges. Mountain Empire Schools District's former superintendent Steve Van Zandt, known as the Charter School King, pled guilty of felony violation of the Political Reform Act and agreed to repay stipends he had pocketed for each school chartered by the district. Dumanis served as a prosecutor and Superior Court judge before being elected district attorney. She ran for mayor in 2012 but lost that election to Bob Filner. She drew controversy over contributions funneled into her campaign from a Mexican business mogul, Jose Susumo Azano Matsura, but he has denied any wrongdoing. Sheriff Bill Gore praised Dumanis for her handling of criminal justice matters at a time when California has transferred much of the responsibility from the state to local law enforcement for handling low-level criminals. Collaboration is critical, and she's done a great job of that, Sheriff Gore said. Stephen Walter, president of the San Diego Deputy District Attorneys Association, issued a statement calling Dumanis tremendously supportive of every member of this team. He praised her for providing support to fulfill her motto of doing the right thing. But Reverend Shane Harris with the National Association Action Network says he is overjoyed to hear that Dumanis won't seek re-election. He has criticized her for not prosecuting police officers in high-profile cases, including the shooting of Alfred Alongo in El Cajon and the choking unconscious of Robert Branch by San Diego police. Harris states, "Now, as communities of color, we will commit ourselves to seeking a candidate to be the next district attorney of San Diego County. We see this as an opportunity to really be a part of the shifting of an office that we in the civil rights community believe can truly represent the justice we are fighting for. It's a big, big decision," Dumanis, 65, said of her decision to not seek re-election, adding that she feels both profound sadness and profound pride. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Rebecca Williamson.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Donnie Gentile. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.